hi, everybody. I'm really glad to be back, and I'm excited to explore the topic that we have on our hands today.
I'm also excited being here. Something special about co-leading a teleclass with Mickey. Looking forward to our time together.
I want to start today's class by looking at the challenge, which, as I think about it, is like a microcosm of a larger challenge. And the challenge is, if you're working somewhere, in an organization somewhere, and the organization is not one of the extremely few organizations in the world that have taken on NVC consciousness as a way of operating, people around you will not be part of the priorities and the principles and even the skills that you are working to cultivate in yourself. And it leaves us with a major challenge of how to face that situation when I have, let's say, a consciousness of attending to everyone's needs, and people around me have a consciousness of whoever does a better job deserves more say. There is tension there. And so this kind of tension is what we want to look at today. And from the point of view of how to empower each one of you, each one of us, to embody and live and model the principles of NVC in your interactions with everyone, stay in integrity with your practice, regardless of other people. It's a way to take leadership of everything around you. So that's my thought of how to frame the challenge that we have today. All right, it's yours, Francois.
As we're looking at this topic, how can we live in VC consciousness at work even when we find it challenging, it seems to make sense to get clear on what are the types of challenging situations that we might be facing at work. And so we brainstormed a little, Mickey and I, and I'd just like to name a few of the ones we found. And then after that, bring you in small groups so you can also brainstorm together, and then we would harvest what we got. So some of the situations we found could be you are at the workplace and you receive a hard-to-hear message, like someone's upset at you. So an example might be that they didn't receive a document from you at the agreed time, so you receive a difficult message. Or you might experience someone at work being harsh or impatient with you. And maybe the last one I'll mention for now, like two colleagues are kind of fighting with each other, quote-unquote fighting with each other.
Anyone wants to add any types of challenges to our list? And ideally, you will have both an example and a way of categorizing what it is. So it's a harsh message, or, you know, you're seeing two other people having a challenge, but without a lot of the detail of the story. So that we kind of like have a map of what are the different types of challenges that people are facing.
We came up with several. One we came up with was stereotyping and not taking the time to break out of that stereotyping, which creates cliques and divisions. That was one. Another was jealousy between individuals or teams that involves conflict. And some of that conflict subcategories was people not getting their way, the other people not following through on agreement, or someone being scared, angry, or hurt, not willing to speak up.
Thank you. I'm really appreciating the way that you boiled it down to such nuggets that are so clear and, to me, very resonant. I imagine they resonated with others. And are you complete?
There was one other, and that had to do with time restraints and the lack of it and driving agenda to get things done. Some of the pressure that people are under, and people are, when they're driven, and there's the time constraints and resources are limited, those can be some really challenging situations.
Yeah. Thank you. Do you have some that you want to add to that?
This is in the nonprofit arena. One item was when a board member agrees to take on a specific task to be completed by the next meeting, and then at the time of the next meeting, nothing has been done on that task. So that relates to following through on agreements, I think.
And I'm curious, what makes you think that this is restricted to nonprofits?
It is not necessarily restricted, but that was the context that it arose in.
I was mostly being playful because I think that is one of the core issues that people come up with in a work setting is, you know, people saying they'll do something and then they don't do it. Anything else?
Again, this happened to be in the nonprofit arena, a board review of the executive's performance or an evaluation of the executive. The third one had to do with the internal stories we tell ourselves in specific situations around feelings and needs language.
Specific to the workplace, some of the cross-racial challenges I've noticed when I use feeling and need language in multiracial settings, particularly one colleague, an African-American male, I'm thinking the feeling language sets up a dynamic of asking to be taken care of, and I haven't found a way to shift the energy toward owning it. Some cross-racial confusions and tensions around feeling and need language. The reason the volunteer piece was so kind of interesting, I think, to us is this is the ideal. This is people totally in choice.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't have some of the baggage of for-profit reward hierarchy, so it should be joyful and even more frustrating because of that lack sometimes.
Got it. Thank you.
Our group can add a few things. One is hoarding of information, looking for bosses to fix interpersonal issues between team members instead of addressing it themselves. Third is mistrust, where team members are looking for unfairness, have that filter on and see everything through that, or see most things through that. Office politics, where the words don't match the behavior. Words, we want to work as a team, but behavior that is contrary to that. Bosses that make demands, not requests. People projecting their feelings onto others versus recognizing that it's their own feelings and it's coming from inside them rather than from someone else. The speaking forcefully with compassion when you're in a group with people who are often very aggressive with their bodies and, you know, keeping others quiet or out of the conversation or their tone of voice. Those were the ones we had.
As we are collecting these, I am finding myself filled with compassion for all of us and what we have to face on a daily basis. I'm appreciating naming all of these things because it reminds me of just how enormous the task is that we take on ourselves when we embrace the practice of NVC, because really the task is to meet all of that from a place of connection instead of give in to that and participate in it. That is the task. So I'm appreciating having the intensity of it named. Thank you. Anything you want to add?
I did want to make a comment about what Louisa just said about how there's some disappointment or surprise, I'm guessing, about nonprofits. What I want to say is in my work, what I see is that any time the passion for something that the organization does is very high, which is typical of nonprofits, when that is high and it's unmatched by an equal amount of structural coordination or organization, those groups tend to have much more stress than for-profit groups, in my experience. And
mm-hmm.
In fact, Marshall and I talked about this, and, you know, he says that American business is one of the most violent, probably the most violent places he's seen, and he's been all over the world. And I would add to that that I think nonprofits are actually more violent than for-profit businesses in my experience. And it's for this reason that people are so open-heartedly passionate about their mission and so frustrated that their structure is in some way not supporting harmony and many times creating conflict over resources, information, for example. So I just wanted to name that.
Thank you. I'm really treasuring that particular insight. Thank you. You wanted to add something.
That whole dynamic when they're like, well, we didn't operate on request. What if people say no and we don't want them to say no?
Yeah. I have a quick thing that I had, you know, kind of like a breakthrough aha one day, which is how I present it to people, is I say, getting someone to do something for you just because you have the power is very expensive currency. Use it sparingly.
I always say, if you give people a choice to submit or rebel, they'll only submit when they have to, and then lo and behold, they're likely to rebel later when you're not on the internet or in some other way. So setting up that submit-rebel dynamic is, it's expensive.
Yeah, the difference between what I heard from you, which is what I used to say in the past, is I used to say it in absolute terms. I used to tell people that's not the thing to do. And now I tell them to be mindful about how often they use it. I just say, you know, if you can get somebody to do something because there is a buy-in, you know the results will be better. So in every situation, see if you can work towards a buy-in rather than just telling people what to do. And some of the time you will need to tell people what to do. I concede that to them. And then they feel more relaxed. I hope that was helpful. Thank you.
I took a couple notes from our group. There was a comment on people coming from a victim position and person felt sort of forced into either being a perpetrator or a rescuer. It'd be interesting to hear you comment on that. And another one was people who don't want to wait and demanding something right now. And another one I think has already been mentioned, but people smiling to your face and then doing something opposite, you know, sort of stabbing you behind your back. How to address that?
Thank you. You get the final say.
I wanted to add something on the nonprofit volunteer thing because that's something I interface with a lot. In that the flip side of that, people are passionate, particularly in the animal welfare field, and they're not known for their people skills, but the other side of it is they come with their own agendas, and so their agenda is to feel good, make a difference, but there maybe isn't a clarity of purpose or clarity of objectives or clarity of tasks. So, or even if there is, people come with their own agendas, and they get almost violent over, well, I want to do it this way, but that's not the way that's set out for everybody to do. And then the last thing I just wanted to add was the dynamic. How, you know, a lot of times, a lot of us are just working either on the phone and or email and or, you know, instant messenger or text or something, and you don't have the benefit of being in front of someone. So sometimes by body language or smiling or something, you can just soften the situation. And so that was another kind of level of dynamic is doing all of this when you're not in front of somebody, which can have its benefits, but also can have its negatives.
Thank you. So this is the field that we're dealing with, and it wasn't our intention that we would give you the answers to all of these things, but more that we will give you a process for how you can work your way through each of your challenges using your NVC consciousness and skills. And Francois, you want to take that next piece about self-connection?
So the first element that we want to bring is to prioritize self-connection. We'd like to work with someone who's been actually filling or exploring the handout just to work with it live. And first, I want to say that a lot of it is close to what we did in last month in terms of dissolving enemy images, and still there are some differences. We're going to look at it from various angles. And as I said last month, I think dissolving enemy images is, at least for me, the core practice. So is there anyone who is willing to play with us and share what you came up with while preparing for the call?
While people are pressing, I just wanted to say that, you know, why we start from self-connection, to prioritize self-connection, because it is by getting connected inside with myself and with my needs and from there my intentions and what I want to do and what's important to me, that is the source of biggest power that I can have in a situation. Whether or not I can change the outside, the self-connection gives me more power.
Okay, so let's work with Sharon. Would you give us a little bit about the context? Just let us know of the context of that difficult interaction you had.
Someone that I have a lot of respect for, deep respect for, and I have had several conversations about cross-cultural communication and coaching. Recently, we had a difficult discussion after I learned from someone else that she had quoted me in an article without asking my permission. And at the time, I was really upset about that because I felt that the information wasn't information I wanted to have out for the general public. It was something I had told her in what I thought was confidence to help her understand another perspective.
Okay. So just, I wasn't fully clear. You were wanting to keep that information confidential?
Yeah, and I guess that wasn't clear. And so she actually quoted me in the article as having said that, which put me in an uncomfortable position. It left me with the feeling that I was being the authority on the African-American perspective when really that wasn't the intent. The intent was to share my view of that particular topic in our discussion, in the context of our private discussion.
So it was mostly about that, not about the fact that you would have wanted to have the credit about the information or
No, not the credit. I think there were two things. One is that I was extremely hurt to find out I had been quoted without her asking permission. So there was a sense of that the trust between us had been broken, and that was really hurtful. And the second part of it was that the information that I had shared, I would not have wanted to go on record as having shared it. It was meant for a personal conversation, not for public consumption.
I can imagine and have compassion for the shock that I guess you experienced when you got aware of that. Yeah?
Yes.
Yeah, so you started touching on that. Like, the first question is, what were the important needs you brought into the conversation? I mean, I don't know if you brought that in the conversation, but you mentioned something around trust and choice. And tell us a little bit about how the conversation went and if you brought some of these needs or others.
Well, unfortunately, I'm still working on learning NVC in time. What I was told was that I was screaming at her in giraffe. It was a very quiet, but not MVC, and I apologize later. What I needed was respect and trust. I needed the trust to be reestablished, and I needed to understand her perspective and be understood. I think I was also needing empathy and connection.
Okay. So that's what you were needing, but those are not the needs you brought in the conversation, right?
No, I brought in a lot of anger that I tried to communicate quietly.
So that's what you wished you would have brought, like from more.
I wish I had read all of the pre-work here first.
So, anyways, you were wanting respect, trust, and you were also wanting to understand her perspective and possibly
and have her understand mine. Yes.
Yeah. Right. Some mutual understanding there. And tell us what is the piece you were wanting the other person to hear.
I think what I was feeling deeply was a lot of sadness because someone I care about a lot, and I think I was really sad that our friendship might be damaged by it. And I was also wanting her to hear my frustration and disappointment. You know, the relationship is very important to me, and I just had a fear in that moment that this issue was going to damage it. Fortunately, it didn't, but I didn't know that at the time.
So that's one of the pieces you wanted her to know, that the friendship is really important for you.
Yeah.
About the outcome.
Yeah.
And also the frustration and disappointment about what had happened. Those were the main pieces.
Yes.
And so, what's your best guess of that person's needs? Let's do two of these things, like one of them being, what is your best guess as of now and what was brought into the conversation? Starting with actually what was brought into the conversation. Did you get any sense of her needs during the conversation?
Yeah, I think really she tried very hard to understand. She gave me the space to explain why I was upset. So I really think she wanted to understand, but she also wanted to be understood, you know, like what led up to it and, you know, that it was an oversight. It was a misunderstanding, really. So on her end, I really felt the need to maintain the connection and to resolve the problem.
But that's what you got from the conversation. And now that you look at it, is there any other needs that are surfacing that you can think were present for her?
I think what would have helped is she had a need for empathy that I didn't give, and also a need to have the friendship maintained, you know, that there wouldn't be distance between us as a result of it. That came out later that it was important to both of us that we be able to resolve this in a way that held the trust as so key, that was important to both of us.
And let me check with you, does that shift something inside you as you connect to the needs that were present for her or that you think were present for her? Does that change something?
It does. It helps me, and I wish I could have seen it in the moment, that, you know, I think my feeling was that I had been wounded and I didn't take the time to look at her needs. But yes, seeing those or imagining them does help a lot.
And let me ask you this, if you were to navigate a situation similar to that in the near future, how would you do that? How would you get prepared? How would you deal with the tension inside as you notice something similar to that now that you learned more and that you went through that experience?
I think the thing that would be really important for me to do is really to get in touch with my needs up front, and I like the idea of envisioning the outcome that I would like, you know, really just to take the time for the self-empathy. You know, I knew I was angry and I knew I was sad, but I didn't do anything more with that.
That's what you would do? And would you also take some time to explore what might be going on for the other in terms of feelings and needs?
I would, but I don't think I had enough information at the time.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah.
I think that's a good thing to do. But in that moment with this situation, I couldn't imagine what satisfactory explanation would be. I guess I would know that she would have needed some understanding or some space to explain.
That's something you could have guessed by yourself without checking with her, yeah?
Yeah.
And just that might shift something, might bring some more spaciousness inside, yeah?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And one of the things that I promote often is even when we don't know what might be going on for others, just try to imagine any kind of scenario so we could go to a place of being more calm. So that's something we have the power to do. Does that make sense to you?
It does, but, you know, there's another thing, and I think comes to play here, and maybe you can give some tips on that. When you're having cross-cultural communication at a really deep level, and there's been, a perceived violation of trust, then a lot of historical interactions come to the surface. So for me, what happened was, did I really know her as well as I thought I did? Or was this just another example of an injustice that was something that's been typical over my lifetime? You know what I'm saying? You know, where you know, there may be racial history that can come into play. And so in an MDC capacity, you know, it's like recognizing that and being able to manage that and process that and see it for what it might be. And it may not be real in the current situation.
Well, what's coming up for me on that is, of course, there's a lot, there's the whole diversity work that many people in NVC are doing that addresses specifically, you know, cross-cultural challenges and any other type of differences, basically, the way I'm seeing it personally. But in general, what you describe for me totally fits in almost any kind of disconnection. Last year, I had something that for me was profound insight. I mean, personally, when I just saw it, let me tell you what I saw. I saw the impact of distrust versus trust. What happens when we trust someone, my take on it, is that we actually choose some specific sets of observations in the past or in the present. And often those sets of observations would be on, let's call it, the positive side, when we trust someone. But when that trust disappears, we start recreating the past. I'm not saying all the time, but often. And then we look at different things that happen, and then we start thinking, that person did that. Maybe that meant this. I thought it was it, but maybe it's something different. And then we start relooking at other things that happened and in the present. So suddenly, we are having a totally different picture. And what happens when we move from trust to distrust, then we start interpreting differently the next thing that happens and then put it in the same basket of distrust. And then, of course, things are inflating. And when we start reacting from that place of distrust, it brings more a sense of harshness that the other person picks up, and her sense of distrust also increases. So that's what I see as the mechanic of conflict. The main thing is trust and the impact that it has when we have it or not. And I just invite all of us to be really careful with the type of observations that we choose. Does that make sense?
It does. But then the question I have is, when there is that, when you have trust and you fear that it's broken, is it that you really just need to stop in that moment and, as part of the self-empathy, catch yourself before you drag all of the history into it? Because once you drag the history in, it's kind of a slippery slope.
Yeah. Actually, I mean, there's a lot I would want to say, but just in terms of balance for the call, let's keep that for later maybe, and let's continue to the sequence of the questions.
Do you mind if I say one line about this?
Please, please.
Just that we all kind of like have an idea that our trust or mistrust or someone is caused by how trustworthy they are. And it's very hard for us to recognize that trusting or not trusting is related to the stories that we tell ourselves, which is separate from what the person actually did, is the story of meaning that we associate with it. And one of the things that I try to cultivate is what I call the assumption of innocence, which is that even if somebody did something that I can't make sense of and looks really awful to me, I want to remember that they're a human being like me acting in the service of needs. And that if I knew and understood their internal experience, then their actions would make sense to me.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
I am complete. Back to you, Francois.
So let's look at question number 3. So what were the obstacles to self-connection for you during the conversation that you had?
I answered it in terms of what could I imagine doing that would have supported me in gaining self-connection.
Okay.
The obstacles. So I guess it's the reverse.
Yeah, that's fine. That's basically
and it would have been, you know, imagining her needs, kind of envisioning how I wanted to show up, and self-empathy.
Next question. What could you imagine doing that would support you in gaining self-connection? So that's some of the things you mentioned already. And now, do you have judgments of this other person for now?
No, I would say 99% no. There was a little bit of about a 1% left,
okay.
But I think Mickey's statement just dealt with that.
Oh, I love dealing with the 1%, because that 1% stays if we don't deal with it and seeds whatever happens next. Even though we think it's only 1%, it's enough to, you know, contaminate things later.
Yeah, I can see that.
Okay, so you're no more judgments left. All right. So that would be complete for our work. And for anyone who has still judgments on some specific situation, we have a process that is there on this handout that can be very helpful. Thank you very much. Anything you want to say before we go back to the group?
No, I'm complete. Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much. Would maybe one or two of you just share one thing that they found helpful or insightful in the piece we did? If you're willing to do that, that's support my own need for connection and something around feedback.
I just really appreciated the kind of gentle guidance back to what was the facts of the issue, because I tend to get, like you were saying at the end, I add meaning to whatever happened. And it's very hard to separate, like Marshall talked about, I think it's the evaluation from the observation. And I'm finding, you know, the only way to get better at that is kind of stumble, but it's hard to do it on your own. And it's always so much nicer to listen to someone else doing it versus stumbling your own way. So I really appreciated that part of it. So that's what I got out of it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This was very helpful. I'm feeling settled and complete, ready to move to the next piece. So back to you, Mickey.
The next thing that we wanted to look at is how do we apply NVC principles to the variety of situations that you came up with in your group. I'm talking about principles as distinct from skills. So I want to go back to, you know, using the language of feelings and needs and having some awkwardness about it. And using the language of feelings and needs is a particular skill, a particular practice, which can be done in the name of a variety of principles. And so I want to look at the principles, because when there is no agreement in the environment around me, there's no explicit agreement to using the NVC language, then I need to find my way to apply the principles without using a language that might create discomfort for people. So I'd like to take the example that we just worked with to show what I mean by principles. One of the principles is to hear the needs behind people's actions, which to some extent Sharon was doing with the other person. Another principle can be what we said already, which is assumption of innocence. And I'd like to see if anybody can think of any other NVC principles that might apply in this situation that will give you kind of like a direction or an intention to hold.
To realize that absolutely everyone is really trying to meet the need. Their strategy might be flawed, or we might judge that strategy as inappropriate.
Right, so that's another principle. Anybody has any other principle that you can think of?
Just remembering what sort of relationships you want to create. And if, as many of us do, you have an intention to be open-hearted and to see others' humanity, just remember your intention.
Okay, so I'd like now to take one other example. Would anybody want to use any of the examples from your group to explore this? What will happen after that is we'll go back into the small groups, and you'll have an opportunity to do it in your small groups. So if no one is stepping forward, I am curious if anyone has anything you'd like to ask or hear or say before you could go back to your group and look at this question of what are the principles that you can bring to the situation that you explored earlier.
I'm holding the situation of translating feelings and needs in situations where there are histories of power difference. And I always need to be reminded of connection before correction. So that's the heart of hearing the needs behind action. But what's coming up for me now, particularly when we think about nonprofits and living really choiceful, self-responsible lives,
mm-hmm.
and I'm already hearing my should stuff in that.
Yeah, because when I'm talking about applying principles, it's applying principles to yourself. Anytime you try to apply a principle to another person, it instantly turns into a should. Then it turns into something you will judge them for not doing. Some years ago, I heard from Kit Miller, who used to be our director at BNBC, she said that she noticed that when she was in meetings with people who had NVC skills, she was less pleasant, less warm, less willing to be empathic, all of that, than when she was in meetings with people who had no NVC skill, who hadn't heard of NVC. And she reflected on that for a while, and finally she realized that when she was in a meeting with NVC people, there was kind of like an unconscious should and judgment that she was applying to the other people, an expectation that they should use their NVC skills. And from then on, she took it upon herself to, in every situation, imagine that she's the only person in the world with NVC skills. So the only question is always, what principle of NVC can I use to make this situation better? How can I take responsibility for making a difference in this situation? It's very easy to sit and analyze what everybody else could do different. That's not what we're about here. Wondering how you feel hearing that.
Rich.
Thank you.
In my situation with an older African-American man, really seeming to have a lot of feeling about my feeling language, I'm realizing I might be able to just say, oh, I'm so wanting. This is only about me, my learning, my wanting to connect with you, wanting to be understood.
Yeah, so it might support you in taking even more responsibility for your feelings than you might have previously.
Yeah, thanks.
And we just named the principle, taking responsibility for our feelings.
Yeah.
Thank you. Anybody else has anything you'd like us to address or you'd like to say before going back to your group?
Part of me is thinking, wouldn't it be nice if these principles were written out somewhere? And I'm thinking, they probably are. And I don't know that I have them, and I'm starting to feel a little bit like, well, will I say the principles accurately? I'm starting to judge myself that I don't have this library of principles right before me.
Thank you. So I have two responses to what you're saying. I'm conflicted about it. One is, yes, there is a list of principles that my sister and Val and I created, and it is posted on the BNBC website. You can kind of like look around and find it. Second is that I would much rather you came up with your own in some way, even if you don't articulate them in the way that I would recognize, because then
well,
they
then
are...
You're in luck, because that's what I do. It's probably not as polished.
And I still, on some level, would have a preference for that, because if you have a library of principles, I'm worried that it will be applied externally. It will have some kind of assured quality to it, rather than arising from the fabric of what your heart is longing for. You see what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
So my preference would be that you wrestle with it, and then go look at the list, and then it will add to you rather than be an external reference. Okay. The instruction is, when you go back to your group, take some of the situations that you named in the previous round and see what NVC principle could you apply in that situation that might make it better. And that's different from thinking about what skills to use. That's the instruction. This is not really about taking turns so much. It's more about the whole group looking at, you know, at several situations together.
I think we're supposed to pick one of the situations that we came up with before and then brainstorm principles that relate to that.
So if I were to take my example, it would be to understand that they are just using commands as a way to meet their needs.
The thing that came to mind for me is trying to imagine what the boss's needs are, that he's communicating with this ineffective strategy.
You know, I think another principle is to walk a mile, you know, in their shoes. And I would imagine that a boss who's constantly making demands, I'm just guessing, but one likely scenario might be that they're terrified of the fact that they really don't know how to be a boss. a true leader isn't demanding. They create the environment where people want to meet the needs all by themselves. He or she is desperate, you know, and so afraid. I'm guessing they recognize at some level that they're unskilled. They don't have as many skills.
I agree with everything you said, but sort of like trying to thwart our principles on the boss.
Not if you can find ways where his needs and your needs meet. Because once you can find that place, then everybody is rowing the boat in the same direction.
Would be an example of that.
If he's a team leader, he or she's a team leader, and he wants to post better numbers next quarter, well, hey, if that is really the need, and, you know, we don't know what the need is, right? We don't know if it's performance, competence. We don't know what it is until we kind of get to know this person's inner thinking better. Mm-hmm. But if that's what it is, then if I can meet him or her there, then now the boat is pointed in one direction.
Welcome back, and would like to hear from anyone who would like to share if you had any ahas or insights from just anything that stands out to anyone from what you discovered in your group or any questions you have.
We were talking about stereotyping and cliques forming and silo mentality sometimes within companies. I was actually looking at the needs list, even thinking of gangs or cliques in that form. The people within the clique have a need of acceptance, appreciation, belonging, community, consideration from the others. And I can see they're having their need met within their clique. The challenge that we had is, how do you expand that to have them connect with a different group and start breaking down that stereotype or silos? I heard Marshall do it like in Rwanda and Croatia, where people identified their needs and then were able to see them in each other.
You're running into a very tough problem, because unless you have authority as a mediator or a change agent or facilitator or boss or something like this, you can't really tell people anything about what they're going to do or not do. All you can do is be a certain way that will create a different atmosphere. I want to make it more concrete, but first I want to know, what is your relative power in relation to the people who are in the clique?
I'm just another individual at this point.
So the only power that you have is the power of your heart. You see what I mean?
I hear what you mean, and I was wondering if there was a process of how to help bring some awareness of different choices are made in those situations.
Only if they agree for you to teach them something. Otherwise, it will be taken as short and lecturing and all the things that people don't want. It's a very difficult thing for us to accept that if we don't have formal authority, the only power that we have is the power of connection. To even create a process assumes something. Why would they agree to it? It's not an idle question.
But it would need to be a benefit that they cared enough about in order to agree to a process.
Or to trust you that you have something to offer or anything. So really the first order of business is for you to form connection with the people whose behavior you're troubled by. And you can choose to express yourself with vulnerability. You can choose to do all kinds of things. But the only way that you can make movement is by making connection. And if you come at this connection with any residual idea that what they're doing is wrong, it will diminish your effectiveness. You want me to spell out why?
I can see that, and if you'd like to spell it out, that'd be fine with me.
Let me spell it out for whatever other outer benefit there is for others, which is, if I think that what you are doing is wrong, my energy towards you is going to be such that you will not be interested in hearing from me. That will make me less effective. Anything else you want to add?
No, that's great. Thank you.
Thank you. So what I would like to do now is to say a few words about empathy in the workplace and then take the last opportunity for you to dip into your small group to look at a question about expression. And the reason we're choosing to put more attention on expression than on empathy is because in a way it's harder to express ourselves using these principles because we have so much to navigate in terms of taking responsibility, in terms of making requests, in terms of navigating vulnerability and clarity and intention and all of those things. And empathic presence in some ways is easier. The main thing that is difficult about empathic presence is the choice. The choice to focus on empathic presence, the choice to focus on reflection, the choice to focus on hearing the needs in the heart of the other person when there's conflict or when we want to be heard or anything like this. So it's really the choice about it that is the issue. But once we are able to choose it, the practice itself is not so difficult. So I want to pose a question to you. What is it that helps you remember to make that choice in your work life? If there are any tips, anything that helps you remember, or anything that you'd like to set an intention that you could share with the group.
I'd like to keep it in mind when I think about how be diminished without the connection, that I'll be smaller without connecting to others, and that I'm bigger with them than without them.
So that's what you use to remind yourself to counter the tendency to separate and distance.
Yes.
Thank you. I like that one.
Remembering our intentions for partnership, or dogging not for my needs, but for our needs.
Yes, remembering that there is a larger field that includes everyone, that it's not either or. Thank you.
Looking in business, I've typically been result-oriented and get things done. And being introduced to NVC, I found that when we connect with others, it's not only easier to get things done, it's much more enjoyable.
Mm-hmm.
So if I really want to have a life that's enjoyable and still getting things done with greater ease and enjoyment, connecting is a great way to do it.
Thank you. It has also been my experience that it's almost like a sense that the tension of conflict and mistrust consumes brain power, and less of the brain power is available for efficiency and productivity and getting things done. I can delude myself into thinking that it's a waste of time to connect, but if I don't do that, then I'm less effective because some of me is consumed by the tension. Has that been your experience too?
Absolutely. And it's much more peaceful. It calms those internal disruptions going on in our thinking. When there's conflict, there's a lot of internal chatter. When it's not there, we can focus and get things done, and we're at greater peace.
Yeah. Thank you. So for another little bit, I want to invite you to go back into your small groups and focus a little bit on expression. How might you, assuming that you've already made the connection through empathic presence, how might you express what you want to express to the other person in the situation that you've been looking at? Remember that the focus is not on what is the observation, feelings, need, requests, but the focus is on how can you express yourself in a way that will fit the context, the environment, the level of comfort of the people, the culture that you're working within, so that you are not setting yourself up as a strange, weird person in your context, that flow in it with NVC consciousness? So that's the last question for your small groups. And I, again, want to see if anybody has a question before the group, or are you clear?
Can you just repeat what we're going to do again, please?
So what I would like you to do is to, again, take one or two of those situations that you've been working with throughout this class and look at how you might express yourself in that situation in a way that is consistent with your NVC consciousness and also consistent with the culture and the context and the people within the organization. Okay, so let's take 8 minutes for that.
Well, I was actually wondering if we could use your example.
You know, this expression assumes that I had a moment of empathic connection prior. Looking back on it, and this happened, about a year and a half ago. I like to think that I've evolved since then.
Well, I mean, that kind of thing really involves, because when somebody's being that forceful and it's hard for you to get a word in.
And it was the way he was using his body. And I, you know, I had a huge insight that when men use their body in a certain way, it can be very subtle. It can be very disturbing for me. And I didn't have that recognition until this very moment. And in fact, I've had a woman use her body. She was, you know, much taller and bigger than me. You know, it's subtle that I tell myself, oh, I'm, you know, I almost doubt these givings that I have, or this
mm-hmm.
sense of, this sense of domination. And I kind of doubt myself because it's so subtle that it's easy to miss up. I'm just celebrating in this moment that, like, I've had this insight, because now that I'm aware of it, I won't be, you know, I won't be so much at effect by it. I can be more proactive, you know, about getting myself more present when it's happening. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So instead of not feeling agitated by it, or, I mean, it almost in that situation feels like there's a need to kind of find an aggressive strategy to kind of match his aggression, but that's not the NVC way. So I'm actually wondering if NVC way is not about changing him, I imagine you still want to be heard in your meeting.
Right. And I think, you know, if my intention is for connection,
mm-hmm.
and if I don't hold a judgment of him, I can still make the same body motions he's making. I can stand up, I can lean forward, in a way that doesn't take away from him, you know, go for more eye contact or raise my voice or even say simply something like, which I wish I had said, because it was about simply laying off across the board 30% of the company. And I thought that that action needed more conversation rather than just cut across with the numbers.
So when you stand up, you would actually mirror, I guess, some, but not the aggression. You would use your body to invite attention to your perspective?
Yes, and do a pattern interrupt, because he was on a roll. And what I wanted to say was, let's slow this down, because we're not going to save, you know, $300,000 if we take a half an hour longer to really discuss this. If I had said something like that, you know, and just stayed with him, and even to, you know, extend some appreciation that I love, because I did love the forcefulness and the action he wanted to take to save this company that was going to go under. So I loved that energy. And could we take that energy and use it in a way, have a conversation that looked at some options, so that if this is the strategy we decided on, that we could leave the room knowing that we looked at every other option as we promised the workforce.
That sounds really positive.
Yeah. See, I can say that now. I was just afraid, this big, tall guy who had all these credentials and the big consulting firms, and I mourned that.
What I liked a lot about the way you mentioned having your way into the conversation was, you know, using your body but in a softer way. So it's like if you tried to interrupt him and he was aggressive, and I'd have the opportunity, but that standing up and leaning forward and just making it clear that you had something to say, I'm really liking the power of standing up and leaning into it. I think that's so valuable, and I wouldn't have thought of it.
You know, to match the energy of his body with the energy of my body, but with a different intention. Not to hear less from him, but to hear more from him in
mm-hmm.
a way that included more options.
And it's also not fighting him, so it's not trying to take the control from him. It's really just saying, there's another perspective to be heard.
Yeah, and you know, the more I work with men, I think it's really important if they're just wired a little differently to really appreciate what they are offering first. That can be a very powerful way to connect with them before I say, well, let's look at this way, you know. So I'm really working on that.
Yeah, I like that. And it's acknowledging their point of view but offering another. Thank you. That looks good.
Welcome back. I just want to, again, hear from one or two people who've had any either insight or question or comment or something that you'd like to share from your group.
Some energy arose for me around the volunteer and nonprofit situation of really going back to those intentions for partnership and the intention for joy and being able to name, is this something you're eager about or dreading? And is this something we really want to do? So shifting from that micro individualist model to a kind of a interdependent model.
Thank you. Okay. At this point, I just really want to hear from a couple of people about what you have gotten from this series, just as we bring this series to a close. What stays with you from this whole series?
Clarity and confidence and some very concrete tools, because I take the handouts and literally use them as a walk through this, fill in the blank kind of, and when I'm in, you know, whatever reaction I'm having, that helps a lot.
Thank you so much. Anyone else, what would you like to share? What are you taking with you from having participated in this?
When you said the only power I have, the power of my heart, that just summarized the whole series, both in how you and Francois and Martha modeled it, in the sense that in the workplace, because there's so much fullness of power, that one thing alone is so powerful to remember and can create the world of change that we're looking for. I really wanted to thank you for that.
Thank you so much, and I think I'd like to leave and end on this note. Francois, anything you want to say for closing?
Thanks, everyone, for joining. Thanks, Mickey.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, everyone.